Corruptions. I'm going to read a statement per the Governor's Proclamation regarding the Public Meeting Act and Public Records Act, which is Proclamation 20-2828, and due to extraordinary public health circumstances related to the ongoing COVID-19 outbreak, participation in this meeting will only be offered virtually. We will be taking attendance and doing introductions, and so I'm going to kick that off. I'm Alicia Topper, Clark County Treasurer, and a member of the CAB as a countywide participant. Adam, if you can introduce yourself.
Hello, this is Peggy Sheehan.
Welcome, Peggy. Go ahead, Adam.
My name is Adam Kravitz, and I am the Director of Outsiders Inn and Vice Chair of the CAB Board.
Thank you. Amy?
I'm all confused here with this thing. I'm used to Zoom. My name is Amy, and I'm from Washougal, and I'm the Poverty Reduction Work Group Steering Committee.
Thank you, Amy. Bridget?
Hi, I'm Bridget McLeman. Community member of the CAB board. It's good to see everybody.
Yes, good morning, Bridget. We have Peggy on the line. Peggy?
Hi, this is Peggy Sheehan. I am also called in as well. Thank you.
And we have Christine and Mary providing interpretive services this morning. Thank you for joining us. David?
Hi, I'm David Poland, and I'm the deaf representative here.
Good morning, David. Doug?
Good morning, everyone. This is Doug Boff, City Council member from the Center, representing Clark County District 2.
Thank you. Hillary?
Good morning, everyone. I'm Hillary Prepula, District 4 community representative.
Thank you. Jamie?
I'm Jamie Spinelli. I now work at CVAB, and I am a low-income representative.
Good morning, Jamie. Janet.
Good morning. I'm Janet from Clark County.
Thank you, Janet. Karen?
Karen Kamaroff, a low-income representative, and I work for the Cowlitz Indian Tribe.
Thank you. Marissa?
Hi, I'm Marissa McDowell. I'm a housing team lead for Cascade Aids Project.
Thank you, Marissa. Melanie?
Hi, I'm Melanie Green. I'm the community representative for District 3, and I also serve on the Community Needs Assessment Subcommittee.
Okay, Michael?
Good morning, everyone. This is Michael Torres of Clark County Community Services.
And then I have Tom.
Hi, I'm Tom Bryant, a low-income rep. I work for Lifeline Connections.
And then there's a user with just the letters K, Addis.
Hi, this is Christy Addis. I'm the director of our Southwest Washington programming for Cascade Aids Project in Vancouver.
Thank you so much, Christy. Okay, did I miss anyone? Okay, hearing no audio, I'll assume I caught everyone. So welcome to our September 1st Clark County Community Action Board meeting. Our first order of business is going to be to approve the minutes of our last meeting, which I believe were May of 2020. So with that, I would entertain a motion for approval.
So moved.
I think that was Doug.
Second.
And Bridget with a second. So I have a motion and a second. Are there any corrections, comments, discussion? Hearing none, we're going to go ahead and take roll call.
Adam.
Hi.
Alicia.
Yes.
Amy. Amy?
What did you say? Sorry.
aye or nay for approval of the May 2020 minutes.
Aye.
Bridget?
Aye.
David?
Aye.
Doug?
Yes.
Hillary?
Aye.
Amy?
Aye.
Aaron?
Aye.
Melanie?
Aye.
Tom?
Aye.
That's everyone.
Thank you. That sounds like a unanimous approval. So motion carries. I'll go ahead and pass the floor over to Rebecca. We're going to discuss the July 2019 to March 2020 outcomes report. So Rebecca.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you. So I had hoped to send you the report in July when we normally would have presented this report. But we canceled the meeting, and then I was going to email it to you. However, I've been having some issue with Canva, and it won't let me download my report without charging me extra. And so I was unable, and I've been unable to get in contact with them, although many tries. So I'm going to pause my screen for just a moment, and I'm going to go actually into the report online and show you so that you can see, at least get a chance to see the report and the results from July through May. No, July through whatever dates. March, that's the March. Those are the dates that I want. Okay, so hopefully you can see my screen. The first part of the report is the participant satisfaction. The program sent almost 9,000 surveys to individuals that are in their programs right now. We had over 1,100 responses for a 12.5% response rate. And a good response rate is in that 10 to 15%. So we're right in the middle of that. And of the responses, 88% indicated a positive overall response. Or experience with our programs. The way we have this working is all of the programs are asking some sort of general overall question, how was your overall experience? And then we take only positive responses. If they did a neutral response, then we don't include that in the 88%. So this is only people that had an actual positive response. Some of the responses from Rentwell, my class was small and that helped with getting more details. So they really liked that. There was a response that the wait times are too long. And that does happen when we have a lot of people trying to get into the system. I'm hoping that at some point I will be able to send this report to you so that you have it. I'm still trying to work with Canva. So this page is just what's being funded. Up until March, nothing had changed, but the next report you'll see will include the COVID funding that we did. It didn't add any new programs per se, but will include additional outcomes and look at the fiscal spending on those. For the expenditures.
So yes. Rebecca, did you say we didn't have that? Those new outcomes and expenditures yet, and that
correct
they'd be coming. Is that in our next sort of report on outcomes, which wouldn't be till what, December or so?
Is that right? November will be our next report. I'm trying to actually think. Normally, I would, yes. So in May we approved the new COVID funding. And then it took us a little bit to get the contracts going. And actually, I'm just starting to receive invoices for the additional funding. So it may or may not show up in the next actual report, which will go through June. If they were entering. Go ahead.
I wondered, could we get a revised list? I can't remember what we decided in May, and somebody was asking me what. what funding we've got. Could we get a revised list of the amounts the different agencies are now getting with the new funding?
Yeah, it's separated out with a different contract, but I can send that information.
That'd be great.
And Bridget, it's also included in the minutes that we just approved for the meeting in May. There's a itemized listing of the organizations and the
right. I was wondering what that brought that total up to, but I could do the math, I guess.
Yeah, it wouldn't have a total amount because they're two separate contracts. For the expenditures for the community action programs, they should be at about 75% for this report through March. And you can see that we had a couple that had spent out very quickly. The food bank, which we do not fund their full program, so they use our funds before they start spending their own private collected dollars. 211 info was right in that 75%. The other ones were really spending right on track, except for Clark College, which had a significant delay to their program. However, they did start spending at the beginning of this year and worked to try to rapidly catch up. For the homeless crisis response system, again, they should be in that 75% range. And you can see that a lot of them are fairly close to that 75%. A few that were not was impact in their permanent supportive housing program and their rapid rehousing. And then the Janus Ascend program. The Janus Ascend program is the one that provides motel vouchers for youth when they're in between. They've been accepted into a housing program, but haven't found housing yet. And so the spending on that program really fluctuates. They kind of hold off on using that fund, especially for winter times when it's really cold. And so they may or may not spend the full amount that they've been contracted. Lifeline had just got their program really going. And so they hadn't spent any funds yet, but they have since. And then the CMAR Community Services Northwest programs, we were still having some technical issues trying to get the right documentation so that we could actually pay them. The SOAR funds are local dollars, so we had a little bit more flexibility on paying those, but the PATH funds are state funded, so we needed to make sure we had all of the documentation together before we started paying for those. None of them were really, all the other ones are pretty much spending about where they should on their programs. When looking at the community action programs for their system performance, as expected, the food programs spend very quickly and they help a lot of people. They track them a lot at the very beginning and then only new people that come in for additional assistance. So you'll see a lot of people right away and then just a few more every quarter. The support services, that includes 211 info and the volunteer lawyers program. They 211, especially in March, at the beginning of the pandemic, saw a significant increase in the number of calls they were receiving. So that's what boosted them up over 100% of their contracted goal. Volunteer lawyers also saw a significant increase on calls regarding unemployment insurance and landlord-tenant mediation. Clark College just started getting going with their program there, and so we'll see more results from that program in the next report. Some highlights that I wanted to pull out, the Clark County Food Bank's Fresh Alliance program distributed 1.1 million pounds in that three quarters of services, which is the equivalent of four blue whales. The volunteer lawyers program helped 174 households avoid eviction. 17 people improved their credit scores and 388 people resolved their legal issues. The SHARES Hunger Response Program provided there are almost 32,000 meals to 552 individuals at ShareHouse. And they also provided 2,300 food packs each week. And during the pandemic, they continue to provide those food packs to the schools for those distributions. And then Partners in Careers provided 76 workshops through the Career Academy program. They helped 4 youth gain employment and 42 adults obtain employment. When we look at the homeless crisis response system, one of the things to remember is that we're not reporting on the system goals in this report, because we can go to the Council for the Homeless's website and see those, and I can pull that up for you. But when we look at just kind of general overall programs, the total people served in our core systems, that's going to be the coordinated assessment program, rent well, things like that. You can see there's quite a few people that have been served there. Outreach and engagement has served 130 people, which is about 65% of their contracted goals. And, you know, that should be, that's right in where we would expect them this point to, through the program. Targeted prevention had served 64 people. As soon as the pandemic began, there was some additional assistance that was starting to happen. Permanent supportive housing should be right around that 100%, because these are, for the most part, permanent housing for people. So they've already been in the housing, but there is some small turnover within permanent supportive housing programs. And that's why that number goes up over 100%, because it's hard to say if a household will graduate from the program so that another household can come in. With rapid rehousing, we were at about 90%, which is a little bit higher than anticipated. Transitional housing was right at 73% on target, and shelter was a little over 100%. And there was some changes due to the rehabilitation of some shelters. So a lot of our shelter participants were able to find permanent housing. And then more when the construction was done, more people were able to come into shelter. One of the things that we are wanting to make sure in most of our programs is that people are maintaining or increasing their income so that they can then become stable. For targeted prevention, they're at about 50% for meeting that goal, contracted goal. Permanent supportive housing, they are doing really well up until through March. I haven't looked at the numbers since then to see if there's been any deviation since really the pandemic took hold. But they had been doing really well maintaining or increasing their income. Rapid rehousing was also doing really well with that goal. Transitional housing was struggling a little bit, but they've been really trying to work one-on-one with their households to make sure that they do work towards increasing income so that they can then graduate from the program. And then shelter was doing fairly well with trying to make sure people were maintaining or increasing their income. And then some demographics for who was being served through the first 3 quarters. We had over 5,000 people include their race information. So you can see that the majority of households being served at the time were white. We did have some Black and African American households, American Indian, Alaskan Native, Native Hawaiian and Asian households being served. The majority of people were in the 24 to 44 age range, which is not surprising. And then we had just slightly more than half the households were headed by a female head of household. When we look at the education, it's fairly even split between only having an 8th grade education, being a non-graduate, and having some post-secondary schooling, with about a third of the participants indicating they had a high school degree or GED. And then some other characteristics that we just kind of pull out. We are always wanting to make sure that we serve those who are chronically homeless. So we had 951 households that met that criteria, We served 292 veteran households and 2,200 households with disabled occupants. That is the quarterly report. And I'm curious, has anyone gone to the Council for the Homeless's website and looked at their dashboard that shows the system? I'm going to pause my screen and I can go in and kind of, for those of you that haven't seen it.
I think I did right after they did a presentation on it. Was it early? So it must have been really early days back in January, February after our retreat.
Yeah, it's really cool. And they've been actually updating and doing a lot of stuff. And Dale's going to be here to talk about the point in time count, and he'll show some of this also. What changes they've made. So if you go to councilforthehomeless.org and you go into about homelessness, there's the data and system numbers and the system dashboard. So it's pretty easy to get to. This is the overall system. One of the big changes that they made is that there's more public facing information. So if you go into any one of these little houses, it's actually going to tell you what program they're talking about. Before, the public facing dashboard was just an overall view of the entire system, and you could see that there were different programs that were contributing to the numbers. But now if you click on one, so let's pull one of our, Janice Ascend is one of our funded programs. If you click on that, it's going to tell you just the information specific to that program. So they've had 100% permanent exits, which we would expect because the point of the program is to go into a permanent housing program. Their length of stays have been about 34 days, which is better than the previous quarter. That's why it's green. And then their utilization rate has gone down to 39%. And anything you hover on is going to give you definitions and talk about that piece for that data point. You can change the report end dates. You can do an annual report versus a quarterly report. It defaults to a quarterly report. You can change the different household types. So you can really take a look and dive down into some of this information. There's also an instructions tab that really takes you step by step on how to use and read the data that's being presented. So highly recommend if you have any questions to check that out. And you can go in and take a look at all of the different programs that are provided. And this is community-wide. This is not just what is funded through the Community Action Advisory Board. But I thought I would just give a quick update about how to find that information and the new changes that they've done for that.
I have website envy.
It's a beautiful dashboard. They've hired Gwen. So Dale does amazing work. Love Dale. But they also hired Gwen. Michael, do you know how long it's been? A little over a year? It's been longer than that. And she's a data guru and is just, it's amazing the things that she has been able to design and come up with. One of the newest things that they've done is an equity report. And so it's the same type of dashboard. So you can look at this. The green is whatever has been highlighted here as the target population. The gray is everybody else or the entire system. So you can go in and play with this. I highly recommend. They have flyers and data points, annual data information. So there's a lot of information that the council is providing through the About Homelessness data. Are there any questions about the reports and the reporting? Again, I apologize, and I do hope to either change systems and provide you with a report that you can actually have and take with you rather than just seeing during the meeting.
This is Melanie. I just want to say thank you for putting that together. I like the format that you provided, and it's really user-friendly and provides really clear and concise information. So thank you for that.
Took a long time for us to get there, but yeah.
Okay, thank you, Rebecca. So we have task force updates on our agenda being remote. I haven't heard any feedback that task forces have been able to meet remotely, but are there any updates from any committee members? Seeing some negative no's. Okay.
The community needs assessment did meet, and we have been meeting.
I was just going to pass that over right over to you.
Great. So the CNA task force has, we did miss, I think, one or maybe two meetings, but we have been going full bore on the CNA. You might remember back in March, I think I knew by then, that we had put in a request with our state contact. Our community needs assessment is supposed to be due in November. But I got approval and a 6-month extension. So it's now due in May, which gave us a little bit of time to focus on other funding that was priority at the time. But we really needed to move on with the CNA. And the biggest part is doing the forums. So we wanted to get qualitative data through the feedback forums and also small group interviews. The small group interviews would be with people that have incomes under the poverty level. And then the forums would be for anyone, all community members to attend. So we have been working diligently on putting those together. And what does that look like in a virtual world? And so up until this month, we were still a little bit floundering as far as how we were going to get this going. But we have decided that we are going to move forward using WebEx in their training module. I have been granted a license with as a high user of the WebEx system through the county. So they got me a full year's license to do. So we're going to do the training module. So I have some stuff to learn for that piece of it. We are still intending on doing breakout sessions, small group discussions that have 4 main questions that we're going to talk about and get feedback on. We're doing a few different polls throughout the event to kind of get a feel for who's in the forum. And just kind of gauge what their current knowledge is, hoping that we can dispel some myths and provide them some good knowledge about what's really happening in households that have a income below poverty. We're also going to continue to move forward on a data walk, which will look very different in a virtual world. Tom is on the task force and he volunteered to put together some slides. So it'll be similar to the data walk that we did last time where we show the results of the survey for each category and then provide some additional supporting data that's happening around that topic. For example, with housing, we might do the trend in the point in time count. So we're still working on getting that together. We are looking at doing it the last week of October. And we will need volunteers to help take notes in the small group discussions because we can't record those breakout sessions. So anyone that's interested in just sitting in and helping with just taking notes of what people are saying, then we'll collect all of that and kind of synthesize that to put into the community needs assessment would be gratefully accepted. Laura Ellsworth with Council for the Homeless is also on the task force, and she's helping me find facilitators to help with the group discussions section of the forum. So we're really working, you know, working with public health and a lot of different agencies. You'll start seeing stuff come out. I need to put a flyer together. We're looking for agencies that would like to sponsor the event with us. There's no charge for sponsoring. The request is that they just help with getting the word out about the forum. We're looking at having 4 forums, one in Russian, one in Spanish, 2 in English, 1 in the evening, and 1 during the day. We're going to do registration for that. So we'll know how many people are participating in each of the events and move forward once we know that information. There's a few task force members on the call today. Is there anything that I'm missing that you should think we should highlight?
I think you did a great job. I think we covered it.
Agreed.
Fantastic. That's our update.
Thank you, Rebecca, Tom, and Melanie. Before I pass the baton over to Michael for a COVID funding update, I just want to put this into context. As of yesterday, August 31st, Clark County has had 2,610 positive COVID cases. 19 of those individuals are being hospitalized right now in our Clark County hospitals. We've had 51 individuals die from COVID-related causes. And right now, our rate per capita is 71.6. So unfortunately, our trend line is holding steady. And across the state, more than 1,905 people have died. And that was as of August 29th. And more than 74,000 people have tested positive. So with that, Michael, can you give us an overview of what we're doing to help relieve some stress from COVID here in Clark County?
Sure, and thank you for that, putting things into context. I think that's very helpful. So what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna go over funds that are going out into the community in response to COVID that are going out into the community through the county, specifically through Clark County Community Services, and are not going through the CAB. You know, and the reason we're doing this is just, you know, to give you like more of a holistic picture of the activities and the resources that that are going out into the community. And also, to be honest, I think it'll give you a little bit of insight into the other things we do staff-wise outside of the CAB. So like, for example, you know, Rebecca, who spends an amazing amount of time and effort, you know, supporting you at the CAB, she's also been instrumental and key in, you know, doing the contracting, the funding arrangements, program setups and stuff like that for some of this. You know, if you ask her where she spent like the bulk of her life the past 2 weeks, it'll probably be around the ERAP, Eviction Prevention Resistance Program, which I'm going to be talking about. But anyway, in the list that you see in front of you, the COVID funding update list, I'm really not going to get into a lot with FEMA. I will explain a little bit of FEMA funding, and I'm not really going to get into the EFSP, the Emergency Food and Shelter Program, because those are not funds that are coming through Clark County Community Services, but I will explain a little bit about them. So funds that we are receiving, again, this is not including the Community Services Block Grant COVID funds that were discussed in your previous meetings that are in your minutes, you know, that was about, I think it was like $450,000, something along those lines. You know, these are the additional funds. So we have a COVID-19 emergency housing grant from the State Department of Commerce that came in. What's listed there as a Q&I shelter. That was $1.146 million. And it was to provide emergency sheltering and quarantine and isolation for persons that were experiencing homelessness that were impacted by COVID-19. So those funds are what was used to establish, you've probably read about it in the Columbian, you may have heard of it in different conversations, an isolation and quarantine site for people who are unhoused. And that's a Motel 6 that is in East Vancouver near Tech Club Drive. It's two buildings. One building is being used in its entirety, and there are two physically separated buildings for expanded shelter of people who are unhoused that have a higher risk of mortality if they got COVID-19 because of an underlying medical condition, age, something like that. You know, it could be pregnancy. So because they are unhoused and they might be either like in an encampment or they might be just on the street, or they might have been in one of our congregate shelters, they are not able to get out of a congregate setting and follow the physical distancing guidelines that public health recommends. So this facility makes it possible for these individuals, sometimes they're a couple, you know, or household that has someone that's high risk, to basically get a room and be outside of a congregate shelter setting or a congregate setting where they can physically separate. The other building is being used for isolation of people who are unhoused or housing unstable, you know, very housing unstable, usually because of an income, that it's been confirmed they've tested positive for COVID-19 and they do not need hospitalization. They do not need intense medical attention. They need a place to ride it out. And they can do that there. They can get a room, they can isolate. And that second building is also being used for people who are unhoused or highly housing unstable, that it's been confirmed that they've been exposed to someone who has COVID-19, but they might not be symptomatic. We do not know if they're going to get sick or not, but they need a place to safely quarantine without potentially exposing others. So this is a place where they can do that. So that funding, that $1.146 million, was enough funding to get us through, well, the grant period was through, originally through September 30th for that amount of dollars. It has since been extended by the State Department of Commerce to December, but it was really only enough dollars to get us through June 30th. So I'm not talking about the grant period, like, you know, how long we're allowed to spend those dollars, but just based on how much this costs, how long it lasts us. So that got us through June 30th. That site continues to operate because we're using CARES Act Title V funds. And that is in the amount that were authorized by the county, in the amount of $2.6 million. So that's for the same activity, but allowing us to function between June 30th and, as of right now, October 31st. There is talk, or there are efforts by the county right now to get the State Department of Commerce to authorize spending of CARES Act Title V dollars through December, and to get additional CARES Act Title V dollars. If that happens, we will be going back, we being Clark County Community Services, will be going back to the County Council and asking for additional CARES Act Title V funding above that $2.6 million to help us to continue to operate the isolation and quarantine site through December. So that has not happened yet, that $2.6 million that we have for CARES Act Title V for isolation and quarantine site is through October 31st. The last thing I'll say about isolation and quarantine site is, since it opened, it has served 170 individuals total. 126 individuals have been served in the expanded shelter. 19 individuals have gone through quarantine there, and 25 individuals have gone through isolation at that site. Any questions on that before I move on? Okay. So while I'm talking about CARES Act Title V funding, that $2.6 million that I mentioned, that's for quarantine and isolation through October 31st. In addition to that, we received, you know, Clark County Community Services asked the County Council for $500,000 of CARES Act Title V funding that would be used for small business assistance of micro enterprises owned by low-income people in Clark County. That is being combined with $500,000 of Community Development Block Grant COVID funds. So for a total of a $1 million small business assistance program that is starting next week, and it will be in effect for CARES Act Title V dollars through October 31st, and for CDBG funds until we run out of funds. But that is really expected to be fully expended before the end of December, because the need, you know, the word, the feedback that we're getting is the need for small business assistance is so high that those funds will be fully expended. Any questions on that before I move on to different activity?
Yeah, I was just curious what that, the small business assistance, what would that include? Like, what does that pay for?
Well, it's going to pay for, so it's being administered by Mercy Corps Northwest. And what it will pay for will really vary incredibly depending on what the businesses, the small businesses need, identify as they need. But it will be used for small loans or grants between $2,500 and $10,000. And it may be used for, you know, assistance with payroll, for, you know, paying back some debt that is that the business owes. It could be used for equipment. I mean, it could be a whole spectrum of things, Karen. It will really depend on what does the business need to remain viable. So there is a heavy priority that we are putting, that the county is putting on, for minority-owned businesses, woman-owned businesses, veteran-owned businesses. So we don't have, you know, it's just starting next week, so we do not know how that will shake out in terms of people that are served. But we do know that in our prioritization matrices, you know, we are really trying to target everyone that's in need, but to give some weight to businesses that are in need that are minority, woman, veteran owned. Any other questions?
Yeah, just to follow up on that, then how is the word getting out to those small businesses about that opportunity?
Well, today a press release is going out, and it's going out in social media because, again, the program has not started yet, and we've really been pretty cautious about getting word out too early and having people ask for assistance that's not there yet. Mercy Corps Northwest is putting it out through its network, and we're also, as I talk about the Eviction Prevention Rental Assistance Program later, I'll let you know about my four organizations and some things we're doing with that. But through a lot of the same network, that work, you know, that the press release, the information is going to be distributed. If there aren't any other questions on small business assistance, the final thing with CARES Act Title V is there's an additional $600,000 that Clark County Community Services asked from the County Council and received to basically support the Homeless Crisis Response System in its adaptation to COVID-19 requirements. And that's funding that helps permanent supportive housing and shelter do the additional cleaning and hygiene requirements from public health. It has assisted with some hazard pay. It is going towards outreach materials and hygiene kits and stuff with outreach to assist with COVID, addressing the COVID-19 pandemic. Some of those resources are going into some rapid rehousing resources targeted to people that are in expanded shelter building and isolation and quarantine. So when that ends, whether it be October 31st or later, anyone that's in expanded shelter, we really want to like minimize the number of people that exit that back into unsheltered homelessness as much as possible. We want them to go into permanent housing. Resources that are going into that, and also some resources that go into case management and targeted prevention, because we know that the need for prevention rental assistance is really, really huge right now. So that's CARES Act Title V funds. Any questions on that before I move on? Okay, so then we've received some additional HEN and what we call HEN pilot funds for a total award from the State Department of Commerce of $1,072,000. And that basically just goes into the Housing and Essential Needs Program as it exists right now. It provides rapid rehousing for HEN eligible households, and HEN is Housing Essential Needs. The eligibility of HEN is really guideline criteria that is established by DSHS, and then SHARE does, SHARE and the Council for the Homeless to coordinate entry now does the screening for it. So the HEN pilot provides rapid rehousing for HEN households that are receiving federal SSI, SSDI, or Social Security retirement income, and they have an immediate need for a rent assistance. But so that's $1,072,000. It basically goes straight into the HEN program as it exists now. That's what those funds were designated for by the state. This may or may not translate into a net program increase, because on the back end, we do not know when or how yet, but we have been told by the Department of Commerce that there is an expectation that there's a strong possibility that there may be a funding reduction to HEN. So part of the reason they designated these funds and they're going straight into HEN is because it may end up just keeping the program level, but we do not know that for sure yet. So in addition to that, we have the Eviction Prevention Rental Assistance Program, and that is an award by the State Department of Commerce to Clark County of $4,930,000. That is for rental assistance of people who are currently housed that owe rent to their landlord. And it pays for, you know, if you are 50% of the area median income or below in terms of your income level, and you owe your landlord, you may be eligible for up to 3 months of rent assistance. You may have read in the Columbian that the Eviction Prevention Rent Assistance Program was like $5.3 million. The reason I said 4.9 is because that's what we get. That's what's come through Clark County. There's an additional $500,000 that is going straight from the Office of Homeless Youth to Council for the Homeless and Janus Youth to provide rental assistance specific to youth. So we are not, the county is not involved in that contracting or distribution of those funds, and it really is targeted towards youth. This $4.9 million is truly, you know, it's really more of a broad population. That program started last Monday, and there are four service providers that are providing the rental assistance. That is Council for the Homeless, SHARE, Impact Northwest, and Lifeline Connections. There are 10 organizations that we're calling by four organizations that are doing outreach and or referrals. And a by four organization is an organization that is run by Black, Indigenous, or people of color, and it's for or other minority historically oppressed communities. So this could also be LGBTQ. And those organizations, they're run by those individuals, and they serve BIPOC or LGBTQ population. You know, that's their target service population. So we have 10 organizations that are doing outreach or referral that are by four organizations, and eight of those organizations are doing outreach and referral. So like they will, you know, send people directly to Council for Homeless, SHARE, or another provider to get rental assistance. So as of Friday, so that started on Monday, as of Friday, ERAP had already received 830 calls for assistance. About $235,000 in rental assistance had been provided. 36% of people receiving rental assistance had identified as racially non-white. 63% of individuals had identified as white. So the The outreach to the BIPOC communities seems to be like, pretty successful so far. Just to wrap up, other funding is ESG, the Emergency Solutions Grant COVID. We know that we have about $760,000 of ESG funds that have been received so far. We know there's going to be a follow-on distribution in under COVID phase two. We do not know how much it's going to be or when we're going to receive it, but it's estimated it will be between $2 and $5 million, but we will need to use local dollars for admin support. And there's also a new shelter program of $2.5 million total over 3 years that we submitted a joint application with the City of Vancouver to the Department of Commerce for. So it comes out to about $800,000 per year to create new shelter beds. That has been received and accepted by Commerce, and we should be receiving the contract for that in the next couple of weeks. So that's all the funding outside of CSBG that's being funneled to the community. Are there any questions?
Yes, this is David Poland. I have a question.
Yes.
Regarding ERAP and the Council for the Homeless, reaching out to different organizations for that are minority groups to try to contact people that are 3 months or more behind in rent. I was just curious if they got a hold of the Deaf Center here. They changed the name. It used to be Tillicum. It's now Washington Advocates for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing.
Yes, they are one of the by four organizations that is being contracted for the outreach and referral.
Thank you. I just wanted to double check. Thank you.
Oh, absolutely.
And to Bridget's earlier question to Rebecca, Michael, would you be able to provide just a quick overview of those funding amounts and sources? It was a lot of information, all great news, and it sounds like it's keeping you and your team busy, and hopefully will help, hundreds of Clark County citizens through this really difficult time. So hopefully having something as a takeaway would be at least helpful for me. I wasn't able to absorb it all just through the verbal update. Any other questions for Michael from committee members?
Yeah, this is me, Nelly. I know that you said that you weren't gonna go like super into it, but a brief explanation of the FEMA funding. I don't remember hearing that.
Sure. So there is no FEMA award or FEMA funding. We applied for the isolation and quarantine site to FEMA to have it be eligible to bill FEMA as a public service activity, and that has been accepted. We will probably never touch that funding, and if we do, it will truly be as last resort, because you can only apply 30 days at a time. So every 30 days, you have to get approved again. FEMA does not let you know ahead of time what they will reimburse you for when you invoice them. So it's really a lot, you never know. And it's still unclear. FEMA has not decided if to be reimbursed, they will require a local match. So, all those factors combined really make it unlikely that we will actually try to use any FEMA funding.
This is Melanie. I have a question about the new shelter grant. So you mentioned shelter beds. What could that potentially look like? Is that just, obviously not building a new shelter, but do you have more details about that?
Well, so it hasn't been created yet. It's just funding to do that. It could look like the purchase of an existing facility that could be used as a shelter. It could be used, it could look like motel vouchers in the community. It could look like funding to existing programs, but that would result in new shelter beds, like additional shelter beds. So if it goes into existing programs, it couldn't just be to sustain existing programs as they are now. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Thank you.
And I would like to ask Peggy Sheehan if she would be willing to give an update from the City of Vancouver's Affordable Housing Fund, because that does lend itself to this discussion about funding. So Peggy, would you provide us with a quick update?
Sure. Well, thank you. And thank you for inviting me. And thanks, Michael, for the update. You guys are doing a ton of stuff and appreciate it. So we also are using some of the money that we received through the federal government as a response to COVID for services and for business technical assistance. We're working with the county on so that our technical business technical assistance programs are similar, because most folks don't know that they live in Clark County instead of Vancouver. There's a lot of addresses in Vancouver. We also have about $300,000 that we're using for some. We've asked for applications from the community for additional services that relate to the response to COVID, and we received about 8 applications through that process, and we'll be announcing that during the month of September. Regarding the Affordable Housing Fund, if you feel free to go to the city's website, we try and keep that updated. We have several projects in process, and during this fall, we will probably have 4 other projects that have received affordable housing funds that will be starting construction. Then we hope to issue a RFQ for 2 years of affordable housing fund at sometime this fall. And then we're also establishing a housing commission that will come to play probably in January. And we will work with them to determine if the city is going to go forward to ask the voters for approval of another affordable housing fund in 2023. So that's what I have for right now. Again, we try to keep the websites up to date with what we're doing, but feel free to ask questions if there's time.
Thank you, Peggy. Yeah, are there any questions, additional questions for Michael or Peggy in regards to funding? Any questions from committee members?
Yeah, hi, this is Jamie.
Hey, Jamie.
Peggy, the last time, I think it was the last time we met in person, you gave us an update on the shelter dollars that you guys had sent out previously. One of those was going to exchange, and I asked about whether or not people were having to pay to be there, because they typically do. Did you find out the answer to that?
So they do have some funding that people don't pay for the first 3 months. But then after that, people do contribute to part of their services there.
Thank you.
Okay, and we do have, thank you so much, Peggy. Thank you, Michael. That was an incredibly useful and helpful update. We do have Dell and Gwen on the phone from, I think it's Council for the Homeless, to give us a point in time count. So we have, we're just a little behind schedule, but I think we'll absorb some of our other business time so we can accommodate almost the full amount of time that you are allotted. It might have to be just a tad bit shorter, but welcome, Dell and Gwen. We're excited to have you here this morning.
Thank you. Just a point of clarification, it's only me.
Okay.
we had a shared meeting before, and I haven't figured out how to change my name just but okay. We'll get there someday.
No worries.
All right. My name is Dale Whitley. I'm the HMIS administrator with the Council for the Homeless. And I'm going to walk through a presentation reviewing our 2020 point in time homeless count and then some of the outcomes and some other reports we have available as well if we have time. So can everybody see my presentation?
Yes. Looks good.
So the point in time count, if anybody is unaware, is a single night best effort snapshot of what what homelessness looks like in Clark County for one day. It's required by HUD and the Washington Department of Commerce. They have kind of some different requirements. So HUD only requires a count every other year. So if you're familiar with counts in Portland, sometimes some of the counties there may decide we're only going to do, you know, the HUD count every other year. But in Washington, the Department of Commerce requires us to perform it every year. So we do our count every year. And I think it's kind of good for us that it keeps us in shape and, you know, our contacts up to date. So we do ours every year. It's useful for looking at trends. So we know that not everybody in our county is able to be counted on one night, but we can look at, you know, the trends from year to year to see which direction, you know, the arrows are going. Are they going up? Are they down? Are they holding steady? We use, every year we try to increase the tools and the effectiveness of our count. So, you know, we look at new technology. We look at, you know, which areas need more volunteers to cover, things like that, just to try and, you know, make sure that it's as thorough and efficient as possible. And, you know, the count allows us to, you know, review areas of our county that need, you know, better planning or funding, you know, different demographics that might have shifted from the previous year to see, you know, what's changed and what needs to be addressed. So, as I mentioned, it's the best available data. So, you know, we know that 100% of the people aren't able to be counted, but we, you know, we use the same methods every year, and we're able to follow those trends to see, you know, which direction our things are going. So when there's two sources and also outputs of the report. One is the sheltered count. So that looks at information pulled from our HMIS system. So all of our shelters, transitional housing programs, they are entering their data into our system, so we're able to pull those numbers out and just have those programs confirm that those numbers were correct for that day. And then also, and domestic violence shelters are not allowed to enter data into HMIS, but we still work with their program managers to get the counts of people that were served for those programs as well. So those are also included in the sheltered account, even though they're not included in our HMIS. And for the unsheltered count, we look at non-HMIS service locations. So places like libraries or food banks, any places where people will go for services but aren't included in our HMIS, we'll have people there with survey forms to collect that information there. We also get information from the Safe Park program. So we have those churches that open their parking lots at night for people to safely park there. And the program director there, he gives me information for those people for that on that point in time count night, so we can get those included. We also coordinate with our school district homeless liaisons. They collect information on all their homeless students and families, and we're able to include that information in the account, so that means. And then one of the biggest pieces of planning and coordination and work that goes into the point in time count is the street count. So we have all these volunteer teams that go out and try and, you know, hit all these spots that we've previously identified where people are known to be or complete a route to ask anybody they encounter to complete this survey. And then we also have this great big Project Homeless Connect event that we hold every year. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. But it's a one day, you know, the service fair on the day of the point in time count where people can go for all kinds of services. And while they're there, everybody's asked to complete a survey, and they're included in the count that way. So some of the process highlights from this year. In advance, we tried to reach out to encampments to ensure people were aware of the upcoming count, to let, you know, just to make them aware so that they weren't, you know, confused or surprised when the point in time volunteer teams went out for the street count. We also reached out to the Vancouver Police Department and the Clark County Sheriffs to hopefully pause sweeps. So we had, you know, our liaisons contacted them to try and make sure that didn't happen. It has happened in the past, and it was very frustrating to our efforts when we did all this spent all this time planning to have this count, and then people weren't where they had previously been because they had been swept. So it was much better this year, and we'll continue to work with them to make sure that doesn't happen in the future. We also, for the second year, used a mobile app called Counting Us. And this has been a great addition to the point in time count. The people who complete the surveys, the volunteers, say this is much easier to just have people answer questions. It's more conversational. You don't have these clipboards with paper getting wet out in the rain. You could just ask them these questions, and we're able to also on the back end more easily compile that information because it's all, it gets added to a database, which is much easier for me to pull the answers from. We also added new counting sites, and we expanded our volunteer drive and training. So we did more outreach in advance to let people know that this was happening and try and increase our pool of volunteers, which was really effective. We had, I think, a total of 60 volunteers helping for the point in time count. And so we were able to have 16 teams out around the county doing the street count. So these volunteers were, people from neighborhoods that wanted to sign up. And, our awesome street outreach teams, they are really the superstars of this whole point in time count process. Their knowledge and experience really contributes to being able to identify where to find people and to have those connections where people are more open and willing to talk with them. And then they also help out in the trainings a lot. So I can't say enough good things about our local outreach teams. So the Project Homeless Connect event, again, I'm going to show you some pictures about that. So this was a banner that we had. For the last 5 years, it's been held at St. Joseph's Church on Andreessen. We've had a Project Homeless Connect event for at least the last 10 years, but the last five, it's been at St. Joseph's. They've been really welcoming, and they have a great facility there. They have a kitchen where they are able to cook hot meals and serve people at tables. So here's a picture of... So at this event, people were able to get haircuts, dental care, vision. They're able to get, a new pair of glasses. They're able to get teeth pulled. They're able to get medical care, their clothing. Lots of great services are available to them on that day. But we also have lots of tables with agencies where they can connect and get help. So here's another table. It's Jake from the Council for the Homeless. And there's some familiar people. Jamie talking with Adam from Outsiders Inn. And here's somebody, looks like they're getting their blood pressure checked. This year we also partnered with the Humane Society. They provided dog coats and lots of dog food, and they also had a pet clinic at the Vancouver the day center on that day. And I usually get questions about whether, because it was about the last day that the day center was fully open, whether the day center was included in the point in time count. And we did have people there with that Counting Us app completing surveys. And we also were able to get information. Everybody who visited the day center was scanned into their system, and we were able to get that list of clients there as well. So we were able to count everybody that had visited the day center on that day. And there's a pet. So this is one of our reports for the results of the point in time count. So this year, the 2020 count was on January 30th, and the total number of homeless people counted was 916. And that was down 4% from the previous year's count. But you can, so 516 people were unsheltered. And that was actually an increase of 6% from the previous year. So the decrease came from our sheltered portion of the count. You can see the 268 people were in emergency shelter, and that's a 14% drop from the previous year. Now, the reason for that was because our biggest family shelters, Share Homestead, and actually it was Share Orchards Inn that was completely closed for renovations during that time. So there, we, you know, there were no people in the shelter, so that's why there was a decrease in the emergency shelter portion. And 113 people were in transitional housing. That was also a decrease, 18%, because we had some transitional housing programs that had ended in December, so prior to the point in time count. Since then, the family emergency shelter is now open with expanded capacity. So, and the, we have new transitional housing programs that will come on board as well. So both of those numbers will likely increase in the 2021 count. Of the 916 people, 45% were women, 55% were men. There was a 23% increase in the number of chronically homeless, and a 12% increase in the adult survivors of domestic abuse. And then there's a little bit of a racial and ethnicity information down here below. 24% of the homeless people counted were people of color. Families and veterans remained stable, even going down slightly. So 120 families with children were counted, which was down 10% from the previous year, and 54 veterans, which was down 2%. So included among the 916 people, again, 120 families with children, 41 young adults aged 18 to 24. That's a 24% increase. And I'll talk a little bit more later about why that was. And 8 unaccompanied minors, which was down 47% from the previous year. And 61 seniors, which aged 62 and up, that was up 7%. And the veterans again, down 2%. So those youth aged 18 to 24. So here you can see a 4-year comparison. In 2020, that number was 41. And although there was an increase, the reason behind that was really in the sheltered portion, because we had a new transitional housing program, Caples Terrace, that had opened this year. And so there were more people, there were more young adults in that, able to be counted because they were in that program. And so it's almost kind of, the program, we kind of have gone back and forth on the classification for it, because we're counting it as transitional housing. They can stay until they age out of it. And if they are able to still pay, they could stay in the unit. So it's kind of, you know, it's a good program and not necessarily a bad thing that there were more people counted in that program. So this chart talks about how not all people experiencing homeless sleep outside. So of the people that were experiencing homeless, 29% were outside, 29% in emergency shelter, 14% transitional housing, and 28%, almost an equal amount to the outside and emergency shelter, living in their vehicles. So when I look at this chart, it reminds me that for every one person that you're seeing outside, there's another person in a shelter and another person living in their car. So some reflections, more people visibly living on the street. So if you have heard from someone or have noticed yourself that it seems like there are more people on the street, the point in time count confirms that. There were more unsheltered people counted on that point in time count day. And more seniors age 62 or older are becoming homeless. This is a trend that we've been noticing for at least the last 3 years. It has jumped quite a bit, that aging population. And among those who reported disability, over 40% identified having a mental illness. So another thing that we like about this mobile app is that this year we were able to add our own custom questions. So beyond the ones required by HUD. So this year we added a couple in here, one of which was a primary cause for becoming homeless. And the top three responses, 28% said lack of income, 13% lack of affordable housing, and 11% a household crisis. And then we also asked, what is your biggest barrier for you to becoming permanently housed? 41% identified a lack of income, another 24% lack of income, and they were disabled. 22% lack of affordable housing, and 11% mental health. So this slide is just talking about how the number of emergency shelter beds has increased considerably since the point in time count. So both, as I mentioned, those family shelters were under renovation are now open and with expanded capacity. And then, you know, as we know, there's been, you know, additional funding that has come across, come open after COVID, that's increasing shelter capacity as well. So this chart is showing the last 4 years of family homelessness, people that were counted in families, going down slightly in 2020. And then the chronic homeless individuals and people with families. So the numbers in blue are individuals, and then the orange number is households. So you can see most of our chronically homeless in 2020 are individuals. And this chart shows those seniors age 62 plus. So you can see the increase in the last 3 years. Back in 2017, there were only 10. And in 2020, that number is now 61. And I think I remember that 12 of those were even over 70 years old in 2020. So we have multiple 2020 point time count reports available at our councilforthehomeless.org website. We have a section there called About Homelessness. And so you can see we have an infographic two-pager that has these charts and highlights of information. We also have a long-form narrative report with several pages of discussions about what we found. And then we have this official data report form, which is just a chart of numbers. Some people just prefer to have a one-page, you know, filled with numbers to be able to review that way. And then some data trends looking back from 2013 to 2020. We also have available on our website annual system reports. So, you know, part of the limitation of the point in time count is it's just looking at one day. But our annual reports look at our homeless numbers and system performance over a year. So for all of the year 2019, you can find those reports. Our next count is planned for January 25th. And the planning meetings and volunteer drive normally start in early November. We might start those up earlier this year because we're trying to figure out how, you know, this COVID era is going to affect the 2021 count. What changes we'll have to make, because it seems unlikely that we'll be able to fit 400 people into St. Joseph's Church for the Project Homeless Connect. So we'll have to figure out what else we can do. Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Is Doug from the top?
The deal, this is Doug. I'm sorry. That was an excellent report. And I want to follow up with a question. With regard to those reporting mental illness, is there a possibility that that might be a low number, that perhaps some of those mental illness just don't acknowledge it?
Yes, definitely. So the information that we collect there is all self-reported. So, yeah, there's no, you know, diagnosis needed or anything like that. It's just the person's self-report of whether or not they have one. So.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Doug. Any other questions?
I have a couple of questions. So you mentioned that Orchards Inn was closed last year for renovations. And I had heard that once Orchards opened back up, Homestead would likely be closing for renovations. Is that going to be the case this year?
My understanding is that they were both being renovated at the same time. So I don't know. And when Homestead their renovations were done, they were also going to have expanded capacity. I know that Orchards is back open, and I'm not sure if Homestead is up to their full capacity yet. So I could get back to you on that for sure.
Okay. And then my second question is, you mentioned that the NAV Center was mostly counted by using the people who scanned in with the city staff.
Yeah.
Does that then mean that many of them were not asked those same survey questions, you know, for like reasons, homeless, demographic information, et cetera?
Yeah. So we weren't able. Yeah, exactly. We weren't able to collect those additional ones. Their information, you know, those people who were scanned in, that wasn't their first time to the NAV Center. We had their previous responses to things like their primary reason for homelessness from the HMIS system. So we were able to collect some of that, but yeah, there could have been, additional questions that we could have asked if they would have all been counted through the app.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dale. If there are any other follow-up questions, we could potentially, Rebecca, if you could send out Dale's email address, maybe we could follow up via email. We appreciate you coming and sharing. This is a really big endeavor for Clark County. It's important to know who is without a home in our community and better position us to help them in the future. So with that, I'm going to close the questions portion of the presentation. I am going to open the floor up for a public comment. Are there any individuals on the phone who would like to address the board? Are there any individuals on the phone that would like to address the board in our open forum? Hearing none, I'll close that portion of the agenda and we'll move on to other business. We have about 2 minutes left for our meeting, so I think we're right on schedule. So go ahead, Rebecca.
We'll do this super quick. I just wanted to throw it out there. January is typically our all-day meeting, and we tend to kind of bring in some bigger training topics on that day. I know that the county is working from home as much as possible through the end of the year. So I'm not sure what that January meeting is going to look like yet. If I don't know that anybody really wants to do an all day virtual meeting. I know I'm not a big fan, but maybe we could look at doing it different. Maybe we could do it over a couple of days. But if you have any thoughts on things that you would like some more information on, some training on, please send me an email and let me know. I'm going to follow up this email with information about the COVID funding that was requested. I'll include Dale's PowerPoint and his contact information. And I'll also include a link to the Council for the Homeless's website for where all of their data is. So that's what's happening with the January all-day meeting. It's kind of up in the air at this point. I also wanted to get one last chance for you guys to let me know if you were interested in attending the Washington Low Income Housing Alliance Ending Homelessness Conference that is in the beginning of October. I've had 4 board members respond. Because it's virtual and the cost is really low, we are able to send every board member if you are interested. I just need to know. We need to get everybody signed up. We have to do it through our office, though. Is there anyone else that's interested in attending?
This is Jamie. I am.
Gotcha.
I am.
David?
So I had planned on attending regardless, though. So how does that work?
Is Lifeline going to be purchasing your?
Most likely, but we might end up using funding to pay for it, though.
Okay. So if you have other funding, that's fine. Let's do that.
Okay.
It's likely coming through the same funding source anyway.
Most likely.
So I have Amy, Bridget, Alicia, David, and Jamie. Is anyone else interested in attending?
Amy Rourke.
I missed that. Who was that?
I think it was Amy.
Yeah, Amy Rourke.
Yep, I have you down. Okay, we're going to send 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 board members, and Tom will go. Tom, if you don't have, if for some reason that work doesn't work out, let me know and we'll get you in under the cap.
I just wanted to mention that I'm already going, but on a scholarship through their program. So I will be there.
Yay, fantastic. Adam, did you also want
to? I'm already going to be going as well under scholarship as well.
Perfect. I'm glad so many board members are getting to go this year. That's what I have.
Wonderful. Thank you. Is there anything for the good of the order before we adjourn our September meeting? Well, I just want to thank you all for coming online. It looks like Bridget, did you want to say something?
I was just looking at the date of our next meeting. It's November the 3rd.
Yes.
Okay. That sounds like an exciting day to have a meeting.
Yeah, it does. Election day. 8 a.m. to 9:30 a.m. We'll kick it off with a good CAP meeting.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you all so much for your time this morning. It's great to see you on camera, and I look forward to seeing you all in November.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Be thank well. You. Stay safe.
Stay safe.